From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When we last spoke with Norm Orenstein, he and his colleague and friend Thomas Mann were talking about the systemic problems with the country's political system, problems that had created a culture of partisan confrontation and a decline in cooperation and genuine deliberation. The title of their book was an answer to the question that you may have asked yourself from time to time, just how bad is it? The title, it's even worse than it looks. Norm Orenstein is back in Utah this week, here without his sidekick, but it gives us a chance to talk about American politics in these months heading into the midterm elections. We'll also update our conversation from a few years ago. Part of what Orenstein was hoping to do was begin a conversation about fixing the system. So, how's it going? Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking to Norm Orenstein about politics. Orenstein, of course, a writer, political scientist, and for several years now, he's been trying to make sense of the dysfunction in the country's governing system. A few years ago, he joined us, along with his longtime colleague Thomas Mann, to take us through the roots of that problem, the demise of order and congeniality, this emergence of extreme partisanship, the weakening of checks and balances. So Orenstein and Mann looked inside the mechanism to get a sense of it, the structures, the rules, the norms, and yes, the money and the media. Orenstein is back in Utah, which is giving us a chance to update that conversation and as well to survey the landscape lately with healthcare reforms now kicking in, the midterms heating up, and speculation already starting for 2016. We invite you to join the conversation today. Do you have your own questions about the state of American politics today and what's going on? 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radio west@kuer.org. You can also interact with us and the show by following us on Twitter at Radio West. Norm Orenstein is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. It's a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. He's also a contributing editor and a columnist for National Journal Magazine and The Atlantic. Along with Thomas Mann, as I said, he's the author of the book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. He's joining us today from the campus of Weber State University there in Ogden, giving a lecture there at Weber State tomorrow, and we'll give you the details about that a little bit later in the program. But Norm Orenstein, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Doug. I really enjoyed the last conversation. I'm delighted to be back.
So I want to start with something that I had read about your introduction to your personal introduction to Congress, to the process. You've written how you were introduced to Congress. This was 1965, you say, at the University of Minnesota. And I wanted you to talk about that introduction, what it is that sort of got you excited about the process. I guess it started with a professor, Gene Eidenberg.
Yeah, exactly, who unfortunately died earlier this year of a brain tumor. But Gene had been in Washington the previous year as a congressional fellow, a program of the Political Science Association, the American Political Science Association, where you work in Congress for a year. And he came back to teach and was just full of stories from the inside. It just captivated me and made me decide that at some point, when I could, I wanted to be a part of that program, and I wanted to do exactly that. And I kept on that path, went to the University of Michigan for graduate school, and then in 1969, Tom Mann, who was also at Michigan in graduate school, and I both came to Washington as congressional fellows. It was a time of enormous ferment. The Vietnam War was dividing the country and the city. We had Richard Nixon as president, a Democratic Congress, a reform movement underway as the conservative Southerners were starting to lose a little bit of their grip on the seniority system, and, of course, party reform that ultimately transformed the way in which we select nominees for president. And I got right into the middle of a lot of those things, and that got me underway.
You worked with Congressman Donald Fraser.
Yes, of Minneapolis.
Of Minneapolis. And you've talked about how this gave you a sense of the craft of being a legislator, of how it works. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that in the sense, and maybe compare and contrast, if you would, what the craft was like then and how it's changing or changed.
Very much so. I was very privileged. Don Fraser was one of the most ardent liberal members of Congress. He was also just a master legislator, and he let me have a desk inside his own personal office. So every meeting that went on, I was able to participate in, and I could see this from the inside. And he was very active in foreign affairs, very much involved in a movement that ultimately led to human rights becoming a core part of our foreign policy outreach. He also was very interested in urban matters and, among other things, helped to transform the way the District of Columbia is governed. He was chairman of what was then the Democratic Study Group, which was sort of the liberal caucus that was very much involved in the party reforms and the reforms inside Congress. And in those areas and many others, despite the fact that he was at the left end of the spectrum, he found allies across the divide, found areas where they could compromise or where they could find common ground, and had a very strong record as a legislator. And I saw that from others, and it's the sort of thing that I was actually reflecting on, especially in contrast to today, with the announcement of the retirement coming up of Henry Waxman. Yeah. 40 years in the House, and I don't think you could find a handful of lawmakers in the 20th century who had a record as far-reaching as Waxman has had, his fingerprints all over legislation and health care, expansion of Medicaid, changes in Medicare, the Orphan Drug Act, tobacco legislation, Clean Air Act, and the like. It reflects on something more broadly. Since the time that I was in Washington, first came to Washington, when you had a very substantial center, the Democratic Party had almost half of its members conservative Southerners. We used to call them boll weevils for that insect that infects cotton mostly in the South. The Republican Party had a very substantial number, maybe a quarter or a third of its members, who were moderates or liberals. We called them gypsy moths for the insect that infects hardwood trees in New England, where a lot of them were concentrated. And that center's gone. It's now sharply polarized. But what the story of Fraser and, more in a more contemporary way, the story of Waxman tell us is polarization doesn't mean you can't solve problems.
Right.
Henry, at the left end of the spectrum, had probably his greatest successes during the Reagan years because he could find allies, and he would work in increments and get a quarter of a loaf or a third of a loaf, and all focused on ways in which you could solve problems. The problem now is we don't have much of a problem-solving caucus, and it's become tribal in nature. It's not simply a matter of ideology. It's if your side is for it, then I'm just automatically against it. And that's what's really led, I think, more than anything else, to the high levels of dysfunction we have now.
Well, you mentioned Waxman, but those problem solvers, you know, their own kind of caucus, is how you put it in writing, John Dingell and Carl Levin and George Miller, they're all leaving. And it's interesting what John Dingell said, that Congress has become, and here's his term, obnoxious.
Yeah, and, I know Dingell well, and I see him from time to time, and, you know, nobody has been more immersed in Congress since he was a child. His father served in Congress. He came as a page. Mm-hmm. So we're talking 80 years around the body, and this is, he will tell you, worse than he has seen it. And, you know, the ones that you just mentioned are all liberal Democrats, but we're seeing it on the Republican conservative side as well. Saxby Chambliss, mm-hmm. Of Georgia is retiring. Saxby was a part of the Gang of Six, a very courageous group that tried to come up with a broad-based solution to the debt problem a few years ago and got spurned. And, of course, he took enormous heat from within his own party for it. Frank Wolf of Virginia, a congressman who's been a leader in trying to deal with the problems of hunger, retiring. the people who want to solve problems now find that it's a particularly frustrating and unpleasant time. And I'm afraid we're replacing our problem solvers with people who are making the existing tribal dynamic worse.
We spoke several years ago about the particulars of why it works like that. And I want to come back to some of this as we go along, but let me get your general sense now. It's been a couple of years since you wrote the book, since you worked through some of the details. You even made recommendations, which we'll come to, as to how to help deal with the problem, solve the problem. Filibuster reform is one thing, and there's some form of filibuster reform that has gone on in the Senate, and we'll talk about that as well. But broadly, is it worse than it was then?
Tom and I did a paperback version of the book after the 2012 elections, and I almost retitled it, "It's Even Worse Than It Was." there are tiny green shoots out there, signs that maybe it could be modestly better. We had it with this very small-scale budget appropriations deal that Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, conservative Republican in the House, liberal Democrat in the Senate, worked out that at least ameliorated some of the worst impacts of the sequester. And, it's important to remember that, sometimes if you have dysfunctional politics, you impose dysfunctional processes to try and get around them. So to try and solve the debt problem, people in Congress set up this notion that we will have an outcome if you do not reach a deal so horrific and obnoxious and terrible and self-destructive that you couldn't possibly let it happen. And it happened. Across-the-board cuts, mindless cuts in discretionary spending, which means anything other than the automatic programs, entitlement programs, we call them sometimes, like Social Security, Medicare, and the like, hitting defense and domestic areas equally, mindless. So we have spent years now cutting the heart out of medical research, 640 grants that the National Institutes of Health had already green-lighted in the top 17% of all the grants, not funded. And Francis Collins, the head of NIH, said to me, "I don't know which of these grants would be the breakthrough in Alzheimer's or diabetes or cancer, but I do know that they're there among those grants." Crazy cuts like that. So the budget deal basically, softened the blow for 2 years. We have 8 years beyond that. But now we see with what's going on with the budgets ahead. You have a presidential budget and a Ryan budget just put out by Paul Ryan yesterday that have absolutely nothing in common. And the Ryan budget, after Paul Ryan sort of did this deal to try to ameliorate some of these effects, jacks up significantly spending for defense and dramatically cuts spending on education, infrastructure, health research, food stamps, Medicaid, which, by the way, means mostly nursing home aid. People don't realize that. It's hard to feel optimistic about that. Just one small thing. We have this crisis in Ukraine, and before Putin annexed the territory in Crimea, a gesture that Congress was going to get behind Ukraine, the president had asked for $1 billion in aid, and they couldn't even pass it. And then they're ready to pass it, and the House Republicans decide that they could fast-track it through on a voice vote, but they weren't going to do that, so they waited another week. Now, that other week is not going to destroy things, but the signal that it sends, that even in matters of great urgency involving national security, we can't get our act together enough to make a gesture of that sort, it doesn't give you reason for optimism.
Well, we should point out one of the things that we've talked about before was the role of course, money in politics and the role that it has to blame in the dysfunction.
We need quite a day to talk about
quite
that.
Quite a day. Let's point out the U.S. Supreme Court, of course, has just the news just come down that they've struck down limits on federal campaign contributions. A case called McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission. Give us a sense, Norm Ornstein, what this is going to mean, because it's not going to make it better, I guess, from your perspective.
No, I view this as another step down a disastrous road. We knew this was coming. We know that there's a 5-4 majority now for pretty much eliminating all the campaign rules. What's interesting and striking about this is that when John Roberts first came on the Supreme Court, he actually ruled in a case that, of course, we're going to keep contribution limits because that's a direct link to corruption. You know, the Citizens United decision that was authored by Justice Anthony Kennedy made the, I think, rather bizarre linkage disappear between money coming in that was supposed to be independent and corruption, because it couldn't even have the appearance of corruption. Well, we know if you watched some have called it the Sheldon Palooza event in Las Vegas last week, where almost all the Republican presidential candidates or wannabes came and basically bowed down before Sheldon Adelson because he gives independent money. The notion that there's not even the appearance of corruption there. We had Chris Christie make a small gaffe involving the Middle East, where he talked about the occupied territories. Right. And when he realized that that was politically incorrect, he quickly backed off, because you don't want to alienate Sheldon Adelson. You know, it tells you that that's ridiculous. But direct money going to candidates, money solicited by candidates, that has always been the backbone of what the court, going back to the Buckley decision in 1976 and in multiple cases since, viewed as pretty much sacrosanct. Mm. And now the court's blown those up. And I can tell you what's next. I don't know when, maybe a year, maybe two, if we still have the same Supreme Court. They will say, well, now we've really put restrictions on corporations. They're just like people. Why shouldn't they be able to give money directly to campaigns instead of having to do it through the back door? So the goal here is to eliminate all rules. And if you go back and read or reread the book that Mark Twain wrote called The Gilded Age, you will see so many parallels with what we have now. The big interests who basically buy politicians, give them lots of money. To get that money, the politicians agree to give them pretty much what they want. And it's corruption on a grand scale. This may make that age look pale by comparison. And it's going to be corruption that goes in both directions. Now, politicians can solicit money from these big donors, and they will offer them things in return. Or, on the other side, they will threaten them with mayhem if they don't give the money. So it becomes a shakedown scheme. And it's going to be quid pro quo corruption. And, of course, the notion that's built into this ruling, well, this just means that you can give up to the limits to individual candidates, but you can give unlimited amounts to the parties. Now, basically, you can give to these joint committees, and you can pretty much tell the party, I'm giving you $1 million. I want you to give the money to these candidates. And the money's going to go out, and the candidates are going to know where it's coming from. So it effectively eliminates all contribution limits. And I view that as an unmitigated disaster. And I think John Roberts and Anthony Kennedy have probably done more to ratchet up corruption in our political system than any two individuals in a very, very long period of time.
I wanted to get your reaction to how are you thinking about this Hobby Lobby story, which is, of course, now before the court. They had oral arguments last week, and it sort of raises this idea, a couple of things. Certainly one of them being the unintended consequences of the Citizens United idea about what the status of a corporation. Yeah. What are you seeing in that story?
It leaves me very uneasy. I mean, I want to respect religious traditions, but I think, you know, we often see, I've been to a number of Supreme Court arguments, and it's traditional that you get into the slippery slope side of things. Mm-hmm. Where are you heading? And if you move in a direction where a for-profit corporation can basically decide things that impinge on the rights of others because of their own religious sensibilities, how do you stop? How does that not return you to an area where you say, well, my religion says that African Americans are not people I want to associate with, so I'm not going to let them shop in my stores. I don't like gay people. I'm not going to let them use my services. It's very difficult to draw limits, because once you do, I think perversely, and you start to then draw some lines and say, well, this part is acceptable. You can say, well, contraception, that gets into questions of right to life, and that's one thing, but discrimination on the basis of gender or race or other things, that's not. In effect, what you're doing is saying what is a religious belief and what isn't.
Right.
And so you're actually involving the government more in religion, which to me is a deep violation of the First Amendment. And in the name of the First Amendment, if the court decides in favor of Hobby Lobby, I think what they're going to end up doing is heading down towards a situation which is much, much worse. But I suspect that you can't always tell from oral arguments what direction the court will go in. It sure strikes me that the court is going to rule in favor of Hobby Lobby, probably once again in a 5-4 vote. That's
with Kennedy making the...
Yeah, and you know, Kennedy, I suspect, is going to try and find some compromise, and that compromise, which was discussed by Justice Roberts, mm-hmm. is closely held family corporations. Yeah. But we know that it will be a very short period of time before a publicly held corporation comes up and says, hey, corporations are people. You're discriminating against my kind of people, against other kinds of people. And, you know, finding a rationale for drawing those lines, I find it difficult to imagine how they're going to do that.
Do you have any sense at all whether they intended, or not intended, but, or expected this kind of effect, that something like this would come from a ruling like Citizens United?
You know, it's all speculation on motives and the like. I think that there is a very strong view out there that we're better off with the Wild Wild West. And I think it's partly, maybe it's partly ideological in nature. This is freedom. You shouldn't limit things. It's partly based on a notion that an awful lot of people have, that money is speech, which I find to be a bizarre notion. If freedom comes from having more speech, and I've got my own voice to speak, and you've got a sound system that's the same as the one used at a rock concert to blow the windows off, and we're trying to speak at the same time, I don't view that as something that's a very positive thing. But I also think that there's a lot of partisan motive here as well, that you can tilt the system in favor of a group of people who you want to have greater leverage. And that is, in this instance, those with enormous amounts of money. And the idea that moving to a system of this sort where you have unlimited contributions isn't going to have that effect, I just think is absolutely misguided and wrong. You know, at the same time, we see another element of this in the political thinking and strategy. I've written many pieces about Mitch McConnell and his views on disclosure. You know, back before we had the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform, McConnell led the pack in among those saying, we don't need any of these limits, we just need disclosure. And then as soon as we got the Citizens United ruling, it was disclosure is terrible. It shouldn't be allowed. It would be dangerous for people. And they fought and have succeeded so far in blocking any significant disclosure for these shadow groups that erroneously and illegitimately file with the Internal Revenue Service as social welfare organizations, nonprofit 501c4s. Now, you know, one perverse part of the McCutcheon ruling is, I haven't read the full ruling, but I've read excerpts, and John Roberts says, well, one good thing that comes out of this is these huge contributions now that will go to the parties, those will be disclosed. So disclosure is wonderful. But not to see a cynical set of motives here, I think, is you have to go through some contortions if you're going to do that.
Norm Orenstein is with us, longtime political observer, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's in Ogden this week to give a lecture at Weber State University. It's tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Dumke Alumni Center there on the campus. It's free, open to the public. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We invite you to join us if you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it is a show for you political junkies who may have been taking a breather after the presidential election. Political scientist and writer Norm Orenstein is with us. He is in Utah here to speak at Weber State University. He's been trying to figure out what's wrong with the American political system, the decline in deliberation and cooperation. When we talked to him a few years ago with his longtime colleague Thomas Mann, they doubted things could get any worse, but, well, we're talking about Orenstein, about whether they in fact have, and he's going to be speaking on the campus of Weber State University tomorrow. We'll give you the details about that. He's joining us today. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Norm Orenstein, let's talk about filibuster reform. It's one of the things that you had talked about in your book a few years ago. And there have been some effort to do all of this, impose some changes on the filibuster rules. You weren't exactly crazy with how it happened. You'd hoped there would be more bipartisan support. But there was some effort anyway, Harry Reid doing this sort of unilaterally. You want to talk about that?
Sure. You know, what ended up happening, and this is something that has a longer history. Back when George W. Bush was president and Democrats filibustered several of his nominees for judgeships to courts of appeals, then Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist threatened to do what was then called the nuclear option, which was in the middle of the year to change the rules and basically say you can't filibuster judicial nominations, confirmations. That created a stir. There was a notion that it would blow up the Senate. 14 senators, seven from each party, got together, a gang of 14, and they reached a compromise. They would let through a number of the judges. They would hold back on some that were viewed as ideologically extreme, and that the only way in which you'd see a filibuster of a nomination was under what they called extraordinary circumstances, namely not done in a blanket way, but if there's some real problem, an extreme candidate, a morally questionable one, whatever. It worked fine for some time. The last few years, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of filibusters. And then what we had was for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the most significant one, Republicans, which there have been four vacancies, actually, Republicans said, we don't care how qualified the nominees are, we are not going to approve anybody for this court. And I had expected that when Reid threatened something similar, we'll just move the threshold to 50 votes from 60 votes for executive or judicial nominations, that we would see another compromise, a gang of 14. At that point, there were three nominations for the D.C. Circuit. And you also had one nominee, a longtime member of Congress, smart, well-qualified, Mel Watt, for a major housing post that was being filibustered. You know, you could reach a compromise, let two of the three D.C. Circuit nominees through, let Mel Watt through, and once again, we'll return to the standard of extraordinary circumstances. There were seven Democrats eager to make that compromise. Two Republicans basically stepped up, and nobody else. And so Harry Reid moved unilaterally. That's what we've done with nominations. It hasn't worked terrifically well. The fact is, in the Senate, it's not just a filibuster. There are many ways in which you can hold nominations from moving forward. So Republicans, as a protest, have basically done a slow walk on almost everything. And it's kept the Senate from being functional. I think it's the idea that you're going to filibuster presidential nominees for executive posts, which means the president can't faithfully execute the laws, And that's meant that we've had, for example, vacancies in many critical ambassadorships, which has really hampered our foreign relations, and in a number of other posts. There shouldn't be filibusters on those. Judicial nominations, I actually think, are in a slightly different category. They're lifetime appointments, effectively. So you may want to have a higher hurdle. But if you don't have the sort of cultural understanding that a president has the right to make nominations and we will only keep them from moving forward if there's some extraordinary reason for doing so, instead of doing it in a blanket way, then you have a breakdown, basically, in the normal practices and the basic decency of governing. And that's what we've seen happen here. And this reform is helps it very much at the margins of the margins. But it leads to the larger point, Doug, which is the problem we have now is more a cultural one than it is a structural one. So I'm all for broader filibuster reform. I think the filibuster should return to what it used to be, which is something employed very rarely under extraordinary circumstances when a minority, whether it's a partisan one or not, feels so intensely about something that they're willing to go round the clock and go to great lengths. And we can do that by changing the threshold of the filibuster from 60 votes needed to end debate and move forward to 40 votes needed to keep debate going, make the minority the ones that have to keep coming up and doing the votes and staying around the clock. But we're not going to solve our problems until you change the culture and change the way that the partisans look at each other and view the sanctity of their own institutions. Mm-hmm. And that makes our struggle for making this better a more difficult one. The more tribal we are as a country, and you know, I saw a survey of, a few weeks ago that said that people would be happier having a child marry somebody from another religion than marry somebody from the other party. If that's the direction we're moving in, that's not a healthy direction. And when you look at the coarseness of the culture on the radio and television and elsewhere, when you can have a Ted Nugent refer to the President of the United States as a subhuman mongrel, and basically a few weeks later, you have a candidate for the Senate in Colorado use him as a major fundraiser by auctioning off one of his assault weapons, Ted Nugent's assault weapons, and Nugent every day is campaigning with the Republican candidate for governor in Texas. You know, that's not the kind of language that is going to make it easy to have a political system work. It's very troubling.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Julie is with us in Salt Lake City. Julie, hi.
I've been reading Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, Bully Pulpit, about Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft in the late 19th century and early 20th century period of American history and politics. And it has given me hope, frankly. There seem to be enormous parallels between those two, our time and that time. And I wonder if you see that as well. They got out of it. And I wonder if you see any parallels possible in that book and or in that period and our predicament now.
It's a good question. Finding our way out of it, is it possible in a digital age where media is, I mean, there are a lot of different dynamics, but do you see a way out, Norm Ornstein?
Yeah, and it is a very good question because the parallels are very much there, and the book is a terrific book. And, of course, it was campaign finance scandals that led to the first reforms that Roosevelt, who had not been pure, brought about. It was the backlash against the big interests that led to the regulatory reforms that created many of these agencies that we continue to have. It was the president's use of the bully pulpit, but also the outside forces in the newspapers and the magazines that uncovered much of the corruption that was going on. And, you know, it can leave you a little bit hopeful. I think there are some suggestions now that we don't have quite the driving forces even within the two parties. You don't have something like a progressive movement on the Republican side that Roosevelt led that could help at this particular time. But also, I think we are going to come out of it you look at what it took back then, about 15 years or so. And back then, I should add, you know, you had around the turn of the century a Democratic Party that was a party that had gone off the rails, William Jennings Bryan taking it off, you know, out of the mainstream. Usually it takes three presidential losses in a row or more to jolt a party back, and it takes 15 years or so. The question is, another 10 years of this, where are we?
801-585-WEST. Again, the number two, join the conversation. Julie, thanks very much. Let's go back to the phones. Jim is with us in Lehi, Utah. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually turned on the radio on just as I got in the car and heard the author, the guest, talking about the problem of dialogue in this country and the rather strong language that's used on both sides. And the reason that we can't have a dialogue in this country is we have one party, the Democrat Party, which does not believe that the Constitution binds them to anything, that the words that they say actually have meaning that's fixed and solid. And the other side, who doesn't seem to have any sort of a backbone at all with the Republican Party, and so they don't hold their feet to the fire with their words. You can't discuss things with people if words don't have fixed and solid meanings.
Huh. Norm Ornstein, what do you think?
Well, I will say that I think the dialogue has gotten coarse on both sides. I saw a reference the other day to a note that had been sent to this woman in Michigan who has cancer, who had been the subject of two ads run by Americans for Prosperity, which had said that, in which she said that she had lost her insurance and was going to cost her a lot more. And it turns out with the fact-checking that she was going to be much better off and it would cost her less. Somebody sent her a note saying, "I hope you die, you liar," you know, something like that. I mean, that's just beyond the pale and out of bounds. So, you know, this is not all one-sided. The dialogue is bad, and, you know, I think even the notion that you've got one party that doesn't believe in the Constitution and the other that has no backbone isn't the kind of framework that's likely to lead you to any kind of resolution. Yeah. of these problems.
Because he's saying, see it my way, and my way is that someone doesn't care about the Constitution.
Yeah, and I think, you know, underlying this is something else, which is a real difference in culture and parties now, too. We have a number of surveys that have shown this. When you ask people the question, what do you think would be better if your political actors and policymakers compromised so that they could solve major national problems, or stood on principle, even if it meant that nothing happened? Democrats and independents now, by about 2-to-1 margin, say compromise. Republicans, by about a 3-to-2 margin, say don't compromise. You know, if we want to talk about the intent of the Constitution and read almost anything about the founding period, look at the nature of our political system, the separation of powers, the divisions that we have, they're all built around compromise. There's a wonderful book by two political theorists, Amy Gutman and Dennis Thompson, that delves deeply into this. And it's a matter of finding compromise where you give a little and I give a little so we can solve a problem, or finding common ground because many issues are not inherently ideological in nature. That's at the root of our Constitution. And if you don't accept that and you say, I'm standing firm and what I really want to do is make you back down no matter what, we're not getting anywhere.
Jim, thanks. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number two. Join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Norm Ornstein is with us, longtime political observer, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's in Ogden this week. He's giving a lecture at Weber State University tomorrow night at 7:30. It's at the Dumke Alumni Center there on campus. It's free. It's open to the public, and you can get the details about it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the political scholar Norm Ornstein. He, along with Thomas Mann, is the author of the book It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. He's in Utah this week. He's giving a lecture at Weber State University in Ogden tomorrow night. We'll give you the details a little bit later on the program. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So we should say Nate Silver, the sort of wunderkind of statistics, has been getting a lot of attention the last week or so because he made this prediction on his website, or at least he made an assessment about the fact that the Republicans are likely to win the Senate in these midterm elections. Give me your sense of your reaction. You seemed kind of amused by all the reaction because you said it wasn't exactly novel, this sense of what's going on.
No, I mean, you know, anybody who's followed politics and elections for the last few years, at least, has known for a long time that Republicans had an excellent chance of gaining control of the Senate this next time. There are many more Democratic seats up, and it's not just the numbers, it's what kinds of seats. And, of course, Senate elections are set by what happened 6 years earlier. So if you have one party in a landslide election, which means very likely that they won a number of seats that they would not otherwise have won, then those are going to be very vulnerable. Democrats have 7 seats in very red states, 7 seats up in states that Mitt Romney carried. And Republicans who survived 6 years ago in 2008, which was a Democratic landslide year, are not likely to be in deep trouble in a year that's going to tilt a little bit in their direction. So what Nate Silver wrote is nothing novel, and almost every analyst, Charlie Cook, Stu Rothenberg, and the others who we follow, have been saying it. But Silver has a cachet now because of the 2012 elections. And part of what was so amusing is that Republicans who trashed and condemned him in 2012 when he kept saying Mitt Romney's going to lose, now we're, you know, doing a little victory dance, and Democrats who loved it now are trashing Nate Silver.
Yeah.
But the fact is, Nate Silver didn't say Republicans are going to win the Senate. He said, as of today, there's a 60% chance that Republicans will win the Senate and that they'll pick up the 6 seats necessary with a plus or minus of 5. So it's, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. But it does lead you to realize that we are facing an election in which the House is a virtual certainty to remain in Republican control, and the Senate is at least in a position where there's a pretty strong chance that Republicans could take over. And it does make you think about what the dynamics would be for the next 2 years if that happens.
Well, you've
and written, beyond.
And beyond. You've written that there could be some downsides for the Republicans to taking over the Senate. You've said that it may give them the impression, the party itself, that what you've called, you know, the politics of obstruction, that worked, so we should keep going with that, which is going to have a disastrous effect, or could potentially anyway, for a presidential election 2 years later.
Yeah, I do think that it's so easy to draw the wrong lessons from what happens in a given election. We see this even more. We saw it with this special election for a seat in Florida, the 13th district, just a couple of weeks ago. There was a vacancy. It was a seat that had been held for many decades by a Republican, Bill Young, who had been the chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the past, who died, and a very strong Democratic candidate, frankly, a pretty weak Republican candidate, was a Washington lobbyist. But the Republican won. And, you know, going into the election, almost every observer was saying, don't draw any lessons from these. They're idiosyncratic, very small turnout, one case. But, of course, once it happens, the party that won wants to draw every lesson. And I just almost laughed out loud when I saw Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, who the day before the election had said, this doesn't tell us anything more broadly. And then the day after the election was saying, it's very obvious that this tells us everything about what happens going forward. But in that case, the lesson that was drawn is going after Obamacare is the golden route to big majorities. That's the only thing we've got to do is trash Obamacare. It will explode, implode, and then we can ride that to great victories. You have a number of people inside and outside the political arena now, conservatives saying, hold on here, that may not be the best route to take. But if they win the majority in the Senate, I think that's one lesson that will be drawn. But the bigger lesson, as you said, is, hey, just block anything from happening. Keep this president from getting anything that could be called a victory, and that's our route ahead. But once you take the majority in both houses, it is going to have a lot of people thinking that you're now a part of the governing process. And if we don't move to solve some problems, if we don't deal with the economy and jobs, we don't deal with infrastructure, we see a continuing farce in Washington, and if we don't have any alternatives other than if we just repeal Obamacare, all will be sweetness and light, that's not a great thing for a presidential candidate to take forward. And especially because I think what will happen if the Republicans do succeed here is it's going to give more traction to the more radical wing of the party, which is already dominating the presidential process, and will pull candidates even further to the right. And if you have a candidate who otherwise could run towards the center and capture a broader portion of the electorate, forced to do what, frankly, Mitt Romney did, which is to try to get to the right of almost every other candidate, including, of course, getting to the right of Rick Perry on immigration, it isn't really a formula for success.
You know, I should mention along that line, I mean, over the last year here in Utah, there was this initiative to do away with the caucus convention system in favor of a direct primary. It was this initiative called Count My Vote. It got a lot of pushback from state lawmakers and political parties themselves, but they struck a compromise in this year's session, and they created this alternate path to a primary. A lot of people think it's a game changer, and I'm wondering if you know much about that and if this is sort of a model that could work for the country.
I think it may be a model, although Utah is unique in a lot of ways, and the way in which Utah has used its nominating process, for example, for candidates for the House and Senate, as we saw with Bob Bennett, clearly became a headache in terms of finding a path towards a little more moderation. Now it's a different one, but that is a path that was different from what most other states had had.
Right.
I think the simple notion that there was a compromise in an attempt to try and strike a balance with the different factions is a good sign. I don't see many indications that it's catching on like wildfire elsewhere in the country.
801-585-WEST, again, the number. Let's go back to the phones. James has been waiting in Provo. James, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No worries. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just wondering, I'm 21, I'm just starting college, and it is concerning at my age, especially because, you know, I want to be represented. I want my views to be represented, and I've always thought that electing officials was the way to do that. But how can I and how can people my age, you know, be represented by those who we elect, or how can we get more involved to maybe help our elected officials realize that, you know, we want a compromise, we want things to get done?
That's such a good question, especially coming from someone who's, you know, put yourself in his position, Norm. You know, 21, you're looking at the process, how it's playing out. What do you think?
It is a really good question, and I'm delighted to find people like James who want to get involved and have their views represented. It's a challenge now, and I worry that we're going to get a lot of young people who will become more cynical. You know, part of the challenge is if you look at the House and look at the nature of districts, they are increasingly homogeneous in nature. They don't reflect the broader views of the country. We have a process, partly because of the money that we were talking about earlier, that pulls us towards the polls. You know, you pop up as a candidate, or you look at members. You know, we had a lot of people who, when budget compromises, getting the government started again after the shutdown came up, were threatened with millions of dollars against them in primaries if they got their heads up over the foxhole and voted for a compromise. homogeneous echo chambers that reflect what people hear on talk radio and what they get in their emails doesn't mean you're going to get the broader representation of the public, which has much more of an orientation towards solving problems and compromising. That makes it hard. And I think, you know, we can try and push for some reforms, some of which, as you heralded earlier from the book, that I believe would enlarge the electorate. And I see a lot of moves to shrink the electorate. But, you know, the bigger the electorate, the less the likelihood that more extreme minority forces are going to have the overweening impact that they have now. It's going to take people like James committing themselves to getting involved in campaigns and trying to make sure that candidates hear them, but also moving towards some changes in the system that will take away some of the influence of the big money that pulls us towards the extremes.
A minute left, Norm Ornstein, so not a lot of time. But let me ask you this question. I'll sort of ask the same general question I asked you and Thomas Mann a couple of years ago. Do you have a sense of optimism at this point, or are you feeling a little pessimistic these days?
I have to say I'm more pessimistic than optimistic. I believe we're going to come out of this. I think we are seeing, you know, we have a very vibrant country, culture, private sector. We still have a lot of people who are uneasy about the coarsening that's taken place and the direction in which we're going. But in the short run, I think it's going to get bumpier before we finally reach a smoother path.
Norm Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a columnist for The Atlantic Magazine and National Journal. In Ogden this week, he's giving a lecture tomorrow at 7:30 at Weber State University. It's at the Dumke Alumni Center. It's free, open to the public. You can get details about it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Norm Ornstein, thank you very much for the time.
It's always a pleasure, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Special thanks to our engineer, Lewis Downey. Thanks also to Taylor Almond. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.